Hi, this is Peter Pappas. Recently, I gave a keynote at the Learning Through Literacy Summer Institute in Toronto, Canada, for K-12 educators. The subject of my discussion was literacy in a copy-paste world. Well, I brought my iPod and my iTalk up to the podium, and what I have is a half an hour recording of that talk. For more, you can visit my website, peterpappas.com. Hope you enjoy. I was a classroom teacher for 25 years and I had a great time and only got into administrative role rather late in my career, and I've been doing that in one form or another for the last 9 years. So really for close to 35 years I've been in the information business, and I'm going to be retiring at the end of the month from my day job as assistant superintendent and probably focusing more on some of the other kinds of projects that I do as a writer and a consultant and a trainer. And in doing so, I've been thinking a lot about the information revolution. So I've sort of entitled this Literacy in the Copy-Paste World. And owe a debt of thanks to Tom Friedman, The World is Flat. I don't know if you've read that. It's a great book. You might want to look that up. And also, if you don't want to read quite as much, the latest issue of Wired magazine has a great article which is available free online called We Are the Web. And I will quite freely admit that I have copied and pasted some ideas from them. We'll start with just a little bit of brief history, a few ideas about technology and what technology's been doing, but really take a look at its implication for all of us as educators. Now, here's the question, you know, this is the engagement phase. Can you think of the big internet event that happened 10 years ago this month? 10 years ago this month. Actually, Windows 95 did come out, but that's not the answer I'm looking for, and I'm playing guess what I'm thinking. See, I'm the teacher. See, I know what the right answer is here, and until I get it, I'm just going to say and. Okay, anyone want to try another one? Okay, sorry your time is up, because I can't handle any wait time in my class, so we don't really have a lot of discussions. But actually, what I wanted you to say, and since no one will say it, I will say it, is that that's when Netscape came out. And Netscape was, and there's someone nodding who knew it but wouldn't say it. I know, sure. And Netscape really sort of introduced us to the web, because that's when images began appearing on the internet. And of course, all of you have seen lots of things happen since then. And just to kind of highlight some of the, I think, the technological side, first of all, information's become much more fluid. You know, as a new teacher, I actually started teaching before there were copiers. So, I mean, I had to hand out things, use Mimeo and all that. So it's nice to be able to move information from one format to another, from a digital format to, from email to Word to copy and paste it into something else. Certainly the cost of memories dropped dramatically. The speed in which computers operate is much quicker. We become much more networked through fiber optic, which they thoroughly overbuilt at the last part of the 1990s, and so now the cost of transmission is virtually nothing. We've gone wireless, and we've also adopted the web as sort of a standard interface. So we've really gotten very hooked up over the last 10 years. And, you know, none of us could imagine how much we'd be doing with the internet. In fact, I pulled a quote from Time magazine in 1994, who clearly couldn't imagine what we'd do with the internet, because they said, quote, "The internet will never go mainstream because it's not designed for doing commerce." So clearly no one expected this. So I'm certainly astounded at the kind of information you get, but I'm more struck by just the nature of the information. Not so much the content, but the kinds of things it's doing to the relationships between people and information and just among people. So I would suggest that we've kind of moved to a communication or an information flow that I would characterize as both personal and collaborative. Now you'd think that those are opposite, but I'll show you how they kind of fold together. Let's start at the personal level. basically, you have become your own researcher, editor, and entertainment director. I mean, you go get whatever you want to get whenever you want it. And of course, if you have access to the information technology tools, you have built your own supply network for information, knowledge, and entertainment. And of course, this is the same system largely that everyone else is using. So it's pretty democratic in that sense. I mean, the internet that you use is no different than the CEO or the Minister of Education. You're all essentially using the same one. It doesn't matter if you live in a big city with a great library or in the middle of nowhere. As long as you have a good internet connection, you can be part of the game from anywhere in the world. And of course, that's really the point that Tom Friedman makes. And as the Google CEO Eric Schmidt said, quote, search is so highly personal and empowering. It's the antithesis of being told or taught, which I thought was sort of interesting as an educator. So it's a very personal thing. You go get what you want when you want it. Now, at the same time, it's very collaborative. You can log into meetup.com, and you can find that there are 1,600 members here in Toronto that represent 150 different groups. Everything from survivalists to witches to people, groups around languages. And they have used the internet as a point of meeting one another and actually attending meetings. If you don't want to go somewhere, you can join Yahoo Groups, which has 300 million users in 4 million active groups all around various interests, folks that have crises in their life, people that have hobbies. Or you can just share files with one another. So in one sense, it's both personal. On the other hand, it's rather collaborative, and it's bringing people together. Now, let me give you three case studies. One is dear to my heart. That's Kodak. That's from Rochester. You all know that, right? Yeah. Do you remember their motto was, you press the button and we do the rest? Well, they weren't listening to their market very well because their market was finding other ways of gathering images and processing them and sharing them. And during the 80s and 90s, Kodak was worried about losing market share to Fuji in making film. They never noticed digital coming along. And in Rochester, we went from employing 62,000 people to 16,000 people at Kodak. So basically, they didn't catch on to the information revolution. In contrast, Amazon took another equally old business, which is books. It's actually much older than film, and they figured out how to use it. Essentially, what they did is they opened up their database to the public to be able to go in and utilize their database and look for what they wanted when they wanted to use it. In fact, the users actually write the reviews of the books. In other words, they took the system, the information system, they applied it to a very old business, and they grew. In fact, Jeff Bezos, in 1995, when he opened up Amazon, used to drive the books to the post office in his Chevy Blazer, his 87 Blazer. Okay. 2 years later, he had his millionth customer. 2 years later, he was the Time Magazine Person of the Year. So here's a reflective question. Is education more like Kodak or Amazon? In other words, are we going to sort of get into the flow of information, or are we going to compete with it? Let me just give you one other example, which is me. I taught for years. I worked on lots of projects. I worked on grants, fellowships, all sorts of things, worked with publishers. And, you know, largely I was bound by whatever institutions were kind of the gatekeepers of what I did. You know, my supervisor when I was a teacher, the editor, the grant review person. Back in 97, I launched my first website. It was very popular. It was about document-based instruction. It got a lot of traffic. People started linking to it. Google liked it. More people came. I made more sites. Now I get about 1,000 visitors a day who are averaging over 9 minutes on my site. So even though I'm not in the classroom, I'm now, quote, teaching 24/7. I mean, people are looking at my stuff. And it's also bringing me into relationships with people around projects. And I just clipped a couple of emails here that I got. I'm a graduate student at the University of South Carolina working on a degree, et cetera, et cetera. I'm researching document-based questions. Could you help me on this? Okay. Here's another one. I'm looking for research questionnaires to use with teachers on content area reading. This is from someone at the Teacher Training College in Penang, Malaysia. Here's someone that writes, I put a lot of mock trials online. Here's someone that writes, I'm a law 12 class student in Prince George, British Columbia. I'm the head of the Crown prosecution for the mock trial. I've got to do my closing statement tomorrow. Can you help me? I love that one, you know. And I always get these late at night. But the weirdest one I got, I have to hold this up here. I'm a producer for ABC Television. I came across your website about family workshops. We're launching a new TV show where families are going to participate in an exciting new series where two families switch parents and all that. Are there any families that have gone through your program that you'd be interested in? I said, no, I'm not going to talk to you. So basically what's ended up happening is my role as educator has really changed. I mean, now suddenly I still have institutional connections, but I'm kind of operating outside of that. Now, as you look at the copy-paste world, you know, you see things like eBay, which has essentially created a gigantic flea market with 1.5 billion auctions going every year, totally run by the users. I mean, the users are managing it all. In fact, they even police it with the reviews, the user reviews. Or Wikipedia. Have you heard of Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Anybody heard of Wikipedia? It's actually pretty scary. I mean, if you're someone that values the sort of curatorial functions that we perform, it's an online encyclopedia that currently has 500,000 entries in English. By the way, the Encyclopedia Britannica has 80,000. And you can go in and edit it. For any entry, you can click edit, and you can actually go change it. So you could go in, take an entry, change all the words. So the first thing I think of is, you know, people must be trashing it. And actually, people do go in and deface it, but the average repair time is 2.8 minutes. Because there's all sorts of people that are on there checking it all the time. In fact, one of the top contributors is Brian Dirksen from Edmonton, who's edited 40,000 entries on subjects ranging from kryptonite, you remember Superman, right, to Greek mythology. Or let's take blogging. You've heard of blogging, which is like a web log. I mean, it's basically a website that you can quickly enter text into, and then somebody can comment, and somebody else can comment. There are currently 14 million blogs worldwide. Half of them are active. There's 80,000 new blogs daily. It's like the world's biggest coffee house. So, for example, you could take a trip, and instead of sending postcards, you could put entries from your blog. And if you have your phone set up right, you could actually post photos from your telephone camera and upload them to the blog and keep your family and friends posted on what's going on. Or, for example, if you were a 20-year-old GI like one fellow in Iraq named, who goes by the name Greyhawk, who's now sending blogs back from the Iraq front. And this last year had 1.7 million viewers read his interpretation of what's going on in Iraq. Or you could get into podcasting. Have you heard that? Heard about podcasting? It really doesn't have anything to do with iPods, nor does it have anything to do with broadcasting, but it's basically posting digital audio files online that you can tell your computer to go subscribe to a certain set of files and download it to your computer, and then from there put it onto your listening device, which is what I do, and then when you're in the gym, instead of listening to music while you're working out or driving or whatever, you can listen to an audio file. In fact, I'm actually taping this right now because the iPod can be a tape recorder, and I hope to start posting these things online, which brings us to yet another point, which is I don't know how to edit audio. So I went online and found a free program called Audacity, which you download for nothing, and it's an audio editing software. But I didn't know how to use it, so I downloaded it, took a look at it, said, I can't figure this out. So I Googled how to use Audacity. And you know what I found? Dozens of sites that people had put up on how to use the software. Nobody told them to do it. They didn't work for the company. They're just out there teaching people how to use it. So I actually downloaded the program. Some of them had tutorials. And for example, over the last couple of weeks, I was down in Nashville and again down in Winston-Salem in North Carolina. And I had downloaded these free tutorials onto my computer so that while I'm on the plane, I'm learning how to use a free piece of software when I want to, And I'm being taught, essentially, by someone who voluntarily decided to teach me. So let's think about that in terms of education, okay? Just-in-time instruction provided by who? Provided by somebody that decided to do it, for someone that wanted it. The curious thing is that there's this incredible bottom-up culture of information that's being spawned around us, and it doesn't seem to make any sense. I mean, who's got the time and the energy and the resources to do all this stuff? What's driving it? It's really driven by ordinary people who just decide that they want to put some information up there. And one recent study found that only 40% of the internet is commercial. The rest is just driven by passion and interest. It's unleashed a frenzy of creativity. In the U.S. last year, we had 175,000 books published. We had 30,000 music albums. We have 900,000, nearly a million blog postings daily. Who says people don't want to write? They're writing. And of course, the curious thing is, you know, at some point in the future, if everyone's busy making and altering and mixing and doing things, who's going to be the consumer? Who's going to be the audience? I mean, it's, you know, it's a fascinating thing that's going on around us. Maybe Andy Warhol was right. It's not 15 minutes, but it might be an audience of 15 that we're all going to have someday. And maybe we'll all be writing songs and authoring books and crafting weblogs, because the act of making has become the act of watching, and every hyperlink's both a point of departure and a destination. And ironically, Google is tracking it all. All the activity, the roadmap to the information age is all being laid right now. And someone's watching. So what on earth does this have to do with school? Well, I'm sure if you're sharp people, you've sort of figured out what this has to do with school. But let me give you a moment to reflect on that while I get a little drink. Let me take you back to my old school. See, I went to high school in the 60s, right in the shadow of Kodak, at a kind of working class community, town of Greece. I don't know if you know Rochester at all. It's a kind of inner ring suburb of the city. You know, it was sort of designed to sort kids along the bell curve to go work at various spots in Kodak. Some of the real smart ones became professionals. A lot of the rest might be managerial at Kodak Park. A lot of the rest were going to work on the production line like my dad did. The flow of information was pretty slow and one way and rigid. I mean, you walked into class, the teacher gave you the lecture. If you think about bandwidth, you know, like do you a dial-up modem versus a Roadrunner or cable modem, you know, the bandwidth, the speed of the transfer of the information. Well, lecture is kind of a slow transmission of information, you know, when you think about it. But I sat there and listened to lectures, and of course I was supposed to write everything down in a little notebook. And of course, you think about notebook as a way to save information. It's kind of low memory level and kind of tough to back up your notebook if you lose it, you know. And it was pretty poorly networked and pretty immobile. And basically, I sort of wrote stuff down. And every now and then, the teacher asked me to tell them what I learned, usually in the exact same form that they gave it to me in. And then at some point in the distant future, I got some feedback as to how I did. And that's sort of how my education was. Now I did have some great teachers in there, and if any of you are here, I please know that I could mention you. I mean, you were some good ones. But by and large, I mean, the thinking in the classroom wasn't being done by the students. The thinking in the classroom was being done by the teacher who was designing the lesson. And I never figured out how to think like a historian or think like a scientist or how they might read or write. And certainly when I got a problem, you know, I became a social studies teacher, and early on as a student, you know, I was exposed to that typical American history question, you know, compare the British, French, and Spanish colonies in the New World, you know. Of course, we didn't have Venn diagrams on, I just had to make a list. But, you know, we all knew what the right answer was, right? I mean, I wasn't really thinking, I mean, I wasn't doing Bloom's comparison. I was just filing information and putting it in the right spot. So I guess the big question is, how much of our high schools changed? They've changed a lot in some places. They've changed a lot in some classrooms. In others, they haven't. I don't think we seem to have noticed how much our kids are in charge of the information they get and what they do with it. They now access and store and analyze and share, and they don't need to wait around for you to tell them what's important any more than the rest of us need to wait around for the evening news. You know, we're all struggling to differentiate our lessons. You know, you've been told, you know, you've got to differentiate that. And of course, the kids are downloading customized ringtones on their phones. I mean, they differentiate everything. It's hard for us. They turn to their peers first for information, and they've got lots of ways to connect with one another. And I suspect that the real exchange of information that's meaningful is probably happening out in the hallways or after school or someplace else. There was a recent study done in the United States by a very reputable group that said that of the U.S. teens that have access to the internet, so it's a slice of them, 20% of them are actively hosting their own blogs on a regular basis. So they're writing. And nearly 40% of them are reading each other's. And if you look at what's happened in the mass media, if you look at TV and newspapers and film, all the mass media circulations have all declined. They've all declined the greatest among the young. See, what I'm kind of wondering is what kind of market share of our students' attention we still have. You know, do they see us more like the future or the past? I mean, the real question is when they walk in school a little bit later on this fall, is that going to seem like they're going into the future or going into the past? See, because our gatekeeper days are over. I mean, if we think that we're going to control the flow of information in schools, that's done. And if our kids are going to be literate in a copy-paste world, they really need to be able to find information, to decode it, to critically evaluate it, to organize it into personal digital libraries, and then find effective ways to communicate it with one another. Because information is the new raw material, and kids really need to learn to build with it. And we have to give them the processing skills that are going to enable them to do that in creative ways, ways in which they can solve problems, ways in which they can interact around information the way professionals do. I mean, quite honestly, do you suppose that someday somebody's going to be saying, look, we've got a new vacancy to fill here, you know. We're looking for someone that can really fill out a worksheet, you know. I mean, we've got right places for things to go. We need someone we can come in and train, tell them where to put it, and just get them there to put it in, make sure their name's at the top, and they get it back to us on time, because that's really what we need. Well, I mean, of course, we don't. Ironically, all the most routine tasks are exactly the ones that are going to be taken over by computers. The things that are the most people-friendly and people-dependent are exactly the kinds of skills our kids are going to have, because the folks that can do the routine number crunching are going to find they're competing against someone in another country that'll do it for much less. So the person who's really going to be valued is the person that can be very creative, the person that can empathize. I mean, those are the kinds of kids that we have to build. Now, I don't want to talk about what's going on in the United States with No Child Left Behind. That's my problem, not yours. But we're certainly moving in the wrong direction there. And, of course, the irony is that even our very skilled labor is being outsourced. You know, just about a month ago, I had a CAT scan done. And I had had one before, and I was used to kind of waiting for the, you know, finding out about it. And my doctor called me the next day, and she said, you know, great news. Everything looks good. You know, perfect, fine. Let's not sweat it. I said, wow, that's great. And, you know, I'm kind of, oh, that's really good. I said, by the way, how did you find out so quick? She said, oh, we sent it overseas. And, you know, while we're sleeping, someone's reading it. I thought, oh, gee, that's great. You know, well, later on I was thinking, you know, if I trust someone somewhere else to give me my medical care decisions, like, what don't I trust them to do? Really, think about that. Innovation's moving very fast. Our kids are going to have to come out with skills. They're going to have to be able to learn in the future, because whatever skills they have now is not going to last them for the next 20 or 30 years. And, you know, we folks here in the United States and Canada, we've gotten pretty used to our high salaries. And we're going to have to figure out how to earn them in the future and how to study hard to keep them. So, What do we do in our schools? Well, first thing is I'd stop focusing on technology integration. I don't even know what that means. I'd focus on literacy and critical thinking. You know, our students don't think about integrating technology. They just want to get something done. And they pick up a piece of software, they pick up a device. If it works, great. If it doesn't, they go on to something else. You know, we sit there and say, how's it work? We got to figure this out. You know, if it doesn't work well, it might be not us, it might be the technology. So we really need to think more specifically about how these technology tools can support, you know, critical thinking and teaching and learning, not just the fact that they're a technology tool. The second thing we really need to do is we need to give our students a perspective on how to judge the quality of information. You know, they can go out on the internet and just grab some low-hanging fruit. I mean, the first thing they see, they just take. So it's not about getting information, it's about understanding the source and the motivation of the author. I mean, they can go to a website, and I've been there and I've read it. There's sites out there that say there was no Holocaust. And they look just as good as all the rest of them. And they tell you it's all just a plot. You know, it was just something to gain sympathy for a group of people. So we really need to give our students experience in questioning the validity of what they're looking at and reading and uncovering the motivations of the author. The third thing we need to do is we need to understand that if the information technology provides a great collaborative forum, we have to move that collaboration into the schools instead of having all that collaboration going on somewhere else where we don't know what group they're part of or what group they're interested in. I mean, that used to be the great thing about schools. The big public school was the great melting pot. I mean, we have to reassert that role so that that information and those collaborations that students are forming are happening within the context of schools. And there's one other point, and this is probably most critical. You know, throughout this discussion, I've sort of been assuming that our students could afford all these toys, you know, that they could afford things like this. And we all know that we have lots and lots of students that can't. So a big issue for us in the schools is the equity issue. Because if students don't have access, if they can't afford the tools of technology and the information world, and they're not getting them in school, then they aren't really getting them anywhere. So, in closing, those words you love to hear during any talk. As I said, I started 34 years ago. My career began in a very isolated rural district of 300 students, K through 12, senior class of a dozen kids. I didn't think much about technology integration. I had to figure out how to teach. And over time, I realized my job was not to be a lecturer, not to be the smartest guy in the room, but to really be the architect of the learning environment. And so as all these new devices came along, I got very excited by some I thought were kind of worthless, but I managed to continually look to see which of these new devices, which of these new information technologies can we incorporate into the design of our learning environment? I mean, it's really no different than picking out the tools that you might be picking for your kitchen or the appliances. I mean, the question is, what do you want to do in that space? And I think that these new tools have unleashed a frenzy of individual and collective creativity and collaboration. I think it creates some exciting new opportunities for teachers and students and information to interact in ways that can revitalize teaching and learning. I want to see that brought into our schools. I don't want to see us competing for the attention of our students. I want to see us embrace it. And I think the most wonderful thing I realized about being a teacher was that every fall you get to reinvent yourself. You know, you get to come in and say, here's the best of what I did before. Here's some things I really need to work on. And so as you head into this school year, I want you to think about how you can reinvent yourself, how you can continue to grow. And I wish you all a most engaging and productive school year. Thank you.